Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about insipid infestations and killer condiments. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of K.G. Lewis and our very own Craig Groshek are voice talents Steve Gray, Rissa Montanez, Jeff Sturtevant, Drew Blood, Olivia Steele, Nick Goroff, Danielle Hewitt, Melissa Medina, and Justin Reynolds. Now, get your ticket ready, take your seat in our Theater of the Minds, and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is brought to us by our friends at Velox Books. It is written by K.G. Lewis and performed by Steve Gray, Rissa Montanez, Jeff Sturtevant, and Drew Blood. In it, we meet a man with a particular type of pest problem. Now, without further ado, I present to you, Colonized.
How did he die? I paused before signing the document. If you don't mind me asking. They were required by law to inform me of the death of the previous tenant, but they didn't have to tell me how they died.
Suicide.
How? The manager fixed me with her eyes for a few moments before responding.
I'm not at liberty to discuss that.
It was clear that my question had struck a nerve. Not wanting to irritate her any further, I signed the rental agreement and slid the paper back towards her along with a check for the deposit. The apartment was too cheap to pass up. I wasn't worried that it might be haunted or anything. I didn't believe in ghosts. I only asked about the previous tenant out of morbid curiosity. I moved in 2 days later. That was when I first noticed the strange ant walking along the seam of the counter. As a pest control specialist, I thought I knew every species of ant in the state. But I didn't recognize this one. It was small, even by ant standards. It was a vivid red color, like blood. I watched as it ran over the window and escaped outside through a tiny crack in the frame. Even though I was an exterminator, I still had a lot of respect for insects. Just because it was my job to kill them didn't mean I liked it. I knew how important they were to the ecosystem, and how the loss of a few select species could mean the end of civilization as we know it. You might think I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. Ants were one of those species. Without them, the animals that relied on them for food would quickly die off. That would affect everything else in the food chain, including us humans. Also, other insect populations like roaches and termites would explode if they didn't have to compete with ants for food and habitat. If I could safely and humanely remove insects from a person's home without having to use a pesticide, I would do it. But their size and numbers make that nearly impossible, especially when it comes to ants. Once they established a nest, there was no telling how big it was. Some species are known to create colonies that could stretch for miles. I made a mental note to keep my eye open for any signs that the little ant's colony had infiltrated the apartment. I didn't want to spray if I could help it. That shit is dangerous. I already spent a good part of my day around it, and would like to avoid it in my home, if possible. Thankfully, there were several other ways I could pest-proof the place before resorting to chemicals. I would start by getting the maintenance man to come out and seal off all of the cracks around the kitchen window. One ant was not an invasion, but it was a sign that they might be looking to acquire some new real estate, someplace with easy access to food and water. I planned on making sure they chose somewhere else. The reason I moved into that cheap, run-down apartment was that I wasn't very good with money. The truth is, I had a bit of a gambling problem. Not the casino kind of gambling. My problem stemmed from betting on sports games. I had a great system that worked for a few years, and then I got cocky. I placed a bet on what should have been a sure thing and lost big. Then I started to place bets in desperation, hoping to recoup my losses, but I just dug myself deeper until I lost everything. That forced me to live paycheck to paycheck, with a good chunk of my income going to pay off my last failed attempt to recapture my winning streak. That is also why I moved. I was trying to delay my next payment to Antonio, the loan shark I owed a large sum of money to for my gambling debts. I was going too low for a little while. I just needed an extra couple weeks to scrape together the required amount. A couple of days after I called the office about getting my window repaired, the maintenance man showed up. When he walked into my apartment, he set his toolbox on the floor, opened it, and pulled out a caulking gun.
"You're not gonna call me every time you find a crack in your apartment, are you?"
The tone of his voice conveyed how annoyed he was. "Excuse me?" I was a little put off by his comment.
"These apartments are old. Doesn't matter how many times I seal the cracks. They always keep opening up. I just hope you aren't one of those people who are gonna call me every time you have some minor problem pop up."
"It's the kitchen window," was the only thing I said in response. He walked into the room and caulked around the entire window frame. I knew it was going to look like shit because of how quickly he finished.
"All done,"
he said, walking by me to let himself out of the apartment. As he was about to open the front door, he stopped and turned back, eyeing me for a moment before speaking.
"You know about the old guy who killed himself in your apartment, right?"
"Yeah." I figured the maintenance guy was just trying to rattle me.
"Did you hear how he did it?"
I shook my head and glared at him. I didn't try to hide my annoyance.
"He filled his tub with pesticide. The kind that comes in those big gallon jugs you use on your lawn. And then he took a bath in it. He used to complain constantly about there being ants in here, but I never found any. Dude was crazy, probably high from all that meth smoke wafting up here from the junkie downstairs."
He was referring to the young lady that lived in the apartment beneath me. I figured she might be an addict based on her pale, gaunt appearance and sunken eyes, but I have my own vices and try not to judge others for theirs. The maintenance guy had some nerve. I decided I was going to call him every time I had a problem, no matter how small it was. If my toilet made a noise, I was going to call him. If my lights flickered, I was going to call him. If my next-door neighbor farted, I was going to call him and complain about the smell. After the maintenance guy left, I got to thinking about what he said. Why the hell would someone poison themselves like that? You have to be insane to sit in a tub full of poison. That made me want to scrub my bathtub, and I probably would have if I had any cleaning supplies. Instead, I opted to rinse it with hot water a few times. When I moved into the apartment, I used all of my vacation time so that I could lay low while I saved up enough money to pay off my gambling debt. I thought it was a good plan, but I didn't realize how resourceful Antonio was. The day after my payment was due, there was a knock on my door. There wasn't a peephole or a window I could look out of, so I wasn't able to see who it was before I answered it. I didn't expect them to find me so quickly.
Hello, Steve. You weren't thinking of trying to skip out on your payment, were you?
I wasn't afraid of Antonio. He was a scrawny little weasel of a man. The man I feared was the Neanderthal named Roland that stood mutely behind him. Roland was Antonio's enforcer. No, I said as Antonio pushed his way past me into my apartment. He was followed by Roland, who shut the door once he was inside. I had to move. I wasn't making enough to cover rent at my old place and what I owe you.
That right.
He knew I was lying.
Because it seems to me like you were trying to hide.
I wasn't, I swear. I just needed a little extra time to get the money together. I was gonna pay you.
I want to believe you, I really do. But I feel like I just can't trust you anymore. If you needed more time, all you had to do was ask, and we could have come up with some sort of arrangement.
His idea of an arrangement was to add a fee to what I already owed him. I didn't respond. If I opened my mouth to say anything, it would have just pissed Antonio off even more.
You're lucky I'm feeling generous. I will give you until this time tomorrow night to come up with the cash.
He then started to walk towards the front door. As he walked past Roland, he said,
Show him what will happen if he doesn't have it.
Roland didn't hesitate. He walked right up to me and punched me in the gut. When I clutched my stomach and bent over, he clasped his hands together and slammed them down on my back. Then, when I fell to the floor, he started kicking me. I curled myself into a ball and let him kick me. If I were to try to run or defend myself, he would only beat me harder. I didn't hear them leave. My ears were ringing and my pulse was pounding in my ears. I only knew they were gone because the beating had stopped. I managed to bring myself to my hands and knees as I struggled to stand. Before I could get my feet under me, my arm gave out, and I was flat on the floor again. Something didn't feel right. I couldn't focus my thoughts, and my heartbeat seemed off. It would be racing 1 second, and then it would stop for a moment. When that happened, I felt a shooting pain down my left arm. I clutched my chest, finding it suddenly hard to breathe. I think I'm having a heart attack. I need to call 911. I struggled to get up. I needed to find my phone and call an ambulance, but the pain was overwhelming, and I couldn't orient myself or remember where I put my phone. As I lay there dying, I remember looking at the floor and seeing a tide of tiny red ants rushing towards me. They were coming out of every available crack and crevice in the floorboards. Even they knew I wasn't going to make it. They'd probably devour half my body before someone came to check on me. The old guy who committed suicide wasn't lying. The apartment did have an ant problem. I tried one last time, but it was too much for my body. My head spun, and my vision dimmed before fading to black. The last thing I remember was the feeling of thousands of tiny feet as they marched along my arms and legs and across my face. I awoke with a jolt, having no idea how long I was out. I was both surprised and thankful I was still alive. When I sat up and leaned against the wall, I expected to be more in pain than I was. The only lasting damage I seemed to have was a strange buzzing noise in my head. It sounded a lot like muted static. I figured that was a sign that I had a concussion. I tucked my legs underneath me and slid up the wall until I was standing. I should be dead. I was sure I was having a heart attack when I passed out. I placed the index and middle fingers of my left hand to the side of my neck to check my pulse. I couldn't find it. I tried the other side of my neck. I still couldn't find it. Then I tried my wrist. No matter where I checked, I could not detect my pulse. That was when I also realized that I hadn't taken a breath since I woke up. I stood there and counted the seconds while I waited for my lungs to demand I breathe. They never did. I had no heartbeat, and I wasn't breathing. I was dead. I stumbled into the bathroom and stared at my reflection. I was incredibly pale, and my features were sunken in a bit. As I watched, an ant crawled out of my nose and then ran across my cheek and into my ear. Usually such a thing would have freaked me out, and I would have quickly flicked the insect off, but I had a strange feeling it belonged. I also had a feeling that I needed to drink some water. This idea did not originate from me. It was relayed to me through minor fluctuations in the background noise buzzing in my head. I can't really describe it any better than that. I turned on the faucet, cupped my hand under the flow of water, and proceeded to drink until I felt full. No longer feeling thirsty, I turned off the faucet and walked out of the bathroom. When I caught the sight of the entrance in the kitchen, I suddenly felt hungry. I walked into the kitchen and opened the cabinet doors. As I scanned the shelves, I could feel what only could be described as another presence in my mind. That is what the static was. There was something in my mind with me, and it was trying to decide what we should eat. Peanut butter. That was what it wanted, so I reached out and grabbed the jar. This part might sound disgusting, but it felt natural to me. Instead of eating the peanut butter with a sandwich or on a cracker, I spooned it into my mouth, holding it on my tongue. A few seconds later, a large mass of ants descended upon it and carried it off in small pieces to feed the rest of the colony. I couldn't see them do this, but I could feel them. This act felt perfectly natural to me. When the ants moved into my body, they must have somehow connected me with their hive mind. I knew what the colony needed when they needed it. When the impulse to do something came, I didn't hesitate to act. Everything was for the greater good of the colony. I think I started to understand what had happened to the previous tenant. Being a walking ant colony was a bizarre way to live. I wasn't sure I could handle it. If the colony had tried to move into the old guy, that would explain the bizarre way he killed himself. For the time being, I was happy to be alive and was willing to see how this new arrangement would work out. Out of curiosity, I grabbed a knife from the drawer and sliced a short but deep cut into my wrist. I was not surprised when a river of red ants poured forth from the wound instead of blood. I watched in amazement as some of the ants used their oversized mandibles to pinch the edges of the wounds together while the others secreted a dark substance over the damaged flesh. A few minutes later, there was a knock at my door. I opened it to find my downstairs neighbor standing in front of my apartment. She was the woman the maintenance man had referred to as the junkie. She looked pale and gaunt, just like me.
"Welcome to the colony,"
I heard her voice in my head.
"I'm Abigail."
I raised my eyebrows in surprise. "I can hear you in my head. Can you hear me? This is so weird." I projected those thoughts and many more at her before finally realizing I had forgotten to introduce myself. "Sorry, I'm Steve." I heard her mental laugh as she smiled at me.
"Yes, Steve. I can hear you. We all can."
"Is everyone here part of the colony?" I thought her comment was referring to everyone who lived in the apartment complex. She couldn't keep her smile from growing as her laugh echoed through my mind again.
"No. Just the tenants in this building. If you ever need to reach one of us, all you have to do is think about us, and we will hear you."
It felt good to know there were others like me, that I wasn't alone. Then I started to think about the events of the previous nights, and the threat posed by Antonio and Roland. They would be back just like they promised, and I didn't have their money.
"You don't have to worry about them,"
Abigail read my thoughts.
"The colony provides. The colony protects."
When she spoke, a series of images flashed through my mind. In each one of them, a person was being overrun by millions of ants. Before I could ask her if the images she showed me were real, she cut me off and repeated what she had just told me.
"The colony provides, and the colony protects."
I hope you enjoyed Colonized, as written by K.G. Lewis and performed by Steve Gray, Rissa Montanez, Jeff Sturtevant, and Drew Blood. You can find more of author K.G. Lewis and many others over at www.veloxbooks.com. And of course, you can hear more of these wonderful performers right here on our very own network. Our second tale of the evening is written by Greg Groshek and is performed by Jeff Sturtevant, Daniel Hewitt, Drew Blood, Melissa Medina, Olivia Steele, and Justin Reynolds. You've heard of the attack of the killer tomatoes, but are you ready for the Ketchup Massacre?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
It was the sort of bizarre incident that would forever haunt a small town such as ours. The Ketchup Massacre, we called it. Though it wasn't exactly a massacre in the traditional sense. No one could quite agree on how or when it had happened, but the stories varied wildly. Some said it occurred late at night in the heart of our sleepy suburban neighborhood, while others swore it happened at high noon, but without so much as a soul there to witness it. Regardless, the one thing everyone agreed upon was that it was like something out of a horror movie. I sat at our local diner, Joe's, nursing a cup of coffee and eavesdropping on the hushed conversations around me. The atmosphere was different today, tenser than usual. The Ketchup Massacre had everyone on edge. Gloria, the owner of the diner, approached me with a weary smile.
You look like you've got a lot on your mind, Mark. Care to share?
I sighed, leaning back in my booth. It's just... this whole ketchup thing, Gloria, it's giving me the creeps. I mean, what could have caused such a mess? She nodded, her expression sympathetic.
I know, dear. We're all wondering the same thing. The town's council's holding a meeting later to discuss it. Maybe they'll have some answers.
As if on cue, Sheriff Barnes entered the diner, and all conversation ceased. He made his way to the counter, where Gloria poured him a black coffee. No sugar, no cream. Morning, Sheriff.
Morning, Mark.
Barnes' usually stern face showing signs of exhaustion.
Gloria, have you heard anything new about the ketchup incident?
Gloria shook her head.
Not a word, Sheriff. It's like it happened in a vacuum.
Sheriff Barnes took a sip of his coffee, deep in thought.
Well, folks, we can't let this get to us. We're a resilient community, and we'll get to the bottom of this. I promise you that.
As he left the diner, a sense of unease lingered in the air. No one had a clue how or why it happened, and the absence of answers only fueled our fears. Over the next few days, our town went through the motions of life, but the Ketchup Massacre was a constant shadow. Rumors ran wild. Some claimed it was a prank gone horribly wrong, while others believed it was a deliberate act of vandalism or a murderous conspiracy of epic proportions. But there was one detail that no one could deny. It involved ketchup, and lots of it. Late one evening, I was sitting on my porch, staring at the darkened street, when my neighbor Mrs. Wallace approached. She held a plate of freshly baked cookies, a nervous smile on her face.
Mark, I know it's strange, but would you like some cookies?
I took a cookie and nodded my thanks. Thanks, Mrs. Wallace. It's just been a weird week, you know? She sighed, glancing down the street as if expecting something to jump out of the shadows.
Yes, dear, it has, and I can't help but wonder what's next.
The truth is, The incident, dubbed a massacre, started when thousands of glass ketchup bottles were found in Rick Swenson's yard, mostly emptied of their contents. Instead of being in the respective containers, the ketchup, a bona fide tidal wave of it, from the looks of it, had more or less engulfed Swenson's once immaculate home. And Rick? Well, he and the members of his family, including his wife and four children, were nowhere to be found. That is, until someone checked the basement and discovered their corpses, each of them filled from head to toe, every pore and orifice, with the viscous red condiment. At least that's what the rumors were saying. It all sounded too horrible to be true. An entire family having been essentially embalmed, like Heinz-sponsored piñatas. I couldn't shake the haunting image of the Swenson family's gruesome fate. It was as if they had been transformed into grotesque, ketchup-filled mannequins, their lives cruelly snuffed out in the most horrifying way imaginable. The ketchup massacre had taken an even darker turn, and I was determined to uncover the truth behind this macabre mystery. As night fell, I left my porch and ventured toward the Swenson residence. The air was thick with an eerie silence, broken only by the distant sound of crickets. The moon cast an eerie pallor over the neighborhood, illuminating the now empty yard that had been a sea of ketchup bottles just days ago, before the local biohazard cleanup outfit had removed practically all trace of the incident. The outdoors portion of it, anyway. I approached the front door with trepidation, stepping over and through the police tape, my heart pounding in my chest. I had never trespassed before, and I wasn't exactly eager to have a criminal record. But I needed answers. The Swenson house stood like a looming specter, its windows dark and foreboding. With each step closer, a feeling of dread settled upon me. But I couldn't turn back now. The front door creaked open with a spine-chilling groan, exposing the dimly lit interior. I flicked on my flashlight and cautiously stepped inside. The air was thick with the acrid scent of ketchup, making every breath feel suffocating. My flashlight beam danced over the abandoned living room, revealing overturned furniture and shattered glass. It was as if a violent struggle had taken place here. I moved deeper into the house, my heart racing. As I entered the kitchen, I stumbled upon a chilling sight. Ketchup bottles were scattered across the floor, their red contents spilling out like pools of blood. It was a grotesque tableau, a nightmarish scene straight out of a horror film. While the exterior of the house and the property were more or less back to normal, the interior of the Swenson home told a very different story. I followed the trail of ketchup, my flashlight beam trembling with unease. It led me to the basement door, which hung slightly ajar. The basement was where the Swenson family's lifeless bodies had been discovered, and I couldn't help but wonder if there were more answers to be found down there. Inhaling deeply, I mustered the courage to nudge open the basement door and venture into the darkness below. With each step down the aged, groaning wooden staircase, the temperature plummeted, and the overpowering scent of ketchup intensified. When I reached the basement floor, my flashlight illuminated a horrifying scene. A crimson trail that led from where I presumed the family's lifeless bodies had once lain to a narrow passageway hidden behind a bookshelf. With growing apprehension, I followed the trail, my footsteps echoing in the suffocating silence. The passage led to a hidden chamber, a place unlike anything I had ever seen. The walls were lined with ketchup bottles, arranged in a purposeful pattern, and the room itself seemed to pulse with an otherworldly energy. In the center of the chamber, I discovered a journal, its pages filled with incomprehensible symbols and cryptic writings. It was Rick Swenson's journal, and as I perused its contents, it became clear very quickly that he had stumbled upon a cursed recipe. A dark ritual that involved something inhuman and not of this world, and a veritable buttload of ketchup. As I read through the journal, a voice echoed in my mind, a haunting whisper that filled me with terror. I suspected it may have been the same voice that had driven Rick Swenson to commit unspeakable acts, which later claimed his own life and that of his beautiful family. Now it seemed to beckon to me, promising answers to the mysteries that had consumed our town. But at what cost? The sinister voice, like a siren's call, did its best to coax me from the depths of the hidden chamber. Its haunting whispers filled my mind with promises of forbidden knowledge, but also with warnings of the dire consequences that awaited me. The journal in my trembling hands held the key to unraveling the mysteries of the ketchup massacre, and the voice urged me to read on. The enigmatic writings in Rick Swenson's journal alluded to a ceremony that involved summoning an otherworldly entity hungry for souls. The ketchup, it seemed, was not just a condiment, but a vital component of this ritual, a symbol of the entity's insatiable appetite for human lives. As I continued to read, the voice in my mind grew more insistent, demanding that I complete the ritual, to offer myself as a willing sacrifice in exchange for the knowledge I sought. It promised enlightenment beyond imagination, but it also warned of the horrors that would befall me if I refused. I struggled against the pull of the voice, to resist the allure of the forbidden knowledge. It was as if an invisible force was controlling my thoughts and actions, driving me toward a dark and inevitable fate. Before I knew it, I was overtaken with a sudden craving for ketchup. Ravenously, and to my utter horror and disbelief, I involuntarily began lunging in all directions, whatever sources of the condiment I could find, and began shoveling, scraping, and pouring it into my mouth. Off the floor and walls, out of bottles, gleaned from shards of broken glass littering the floor, it didn't matter where it came from. I needed it in my mouth, and I needed it now. I have no idea how much time passed as I consumed what felt like gallons of the noxious substance, but somehow, some way, in a moment of sheer terror and desperation, I managed to tear myself away from the journal and flee the hidden chamber. The voice in my mind screamed in rage, a cacophony of torment and fury that echoed through the basement. It was not happy I was alive, and even angrier that I was leaving. I stumbled up the creaking stairs, my heart pounding and my legs turning to gelatin, the scent of ketchup still clinging to my clothes. As I burst out of the basement door, gasping for breath, I was met not just with a blast of cool, fresh air, but with the blinding beams of flashlights and the austere faces of the police.
Freeze! Hands where we can see them!
My limbs moved of their own accord, and I found myself raising my arms in surrender. Panic welled up within me as I tried to explain the horrifying ordeal I had just experienced, the unseen entity, and the cursed ritual. But to the police, my words sounded like madness. They didn't see the malevolent force that had taken control of me, forcing me to consume ketchup in the basement of the Swenson house. They rushed me out of the house, their flashlights glaring in my eyes, their voices stern and demanding explanations. The officers were convinced I'd been trespassing and tampering with evidence, and they were determined to get to the bottom of it. The police station was a stark contrast to the eerie darkness of the Swenson House's basement. Harsh fluorescent lights buzzed overhead, casting a sterile glow across the cold, gray walls. I found myself seated in an uncomfortable metal chair, hands handcuffed behind my back, as officers bustled around, preparing to interrogate me. Sheriff Barnes, his brow furrowed with suspicion, entered the room and took a seat across from me. He regarded me with a dour expression, his eyes piercing like daggers.
Start talking, Mark. What the hell were you doing in that basement? And why in God's name were you covered in ketchup?
I took a deep breath, my mind racing to find the right words to explain the horrifying ordeal I had endured. The memories of the unseen entity that had controlled my actions, the voice in my mind, and the accursed ritual from the journal were still fresh and haunting. Sheriff, I know this is gonna sound crazy, but there's something in that basement. Something otherworldly. It forced me to consume ketchup, gallons of it, against my will. I couldn't stop myself. Sheriff Barnes exchanged a skeptical glance with the officers in the room, who listened intently but with evident doubt. I found Rick Swenson's journal. It mentioned a ritual, a dark entity hungry for souls. I think it's still down there, and it wanted me as a sacrifice. The room fell silent for a moment, the air heavy with disbelief. But then, one of the officers, Deputy Rodriguez, spoke up.
Sheriff, we should at least check the basement. Make sure there's nothing else or new down there.
Sheriff Barnes nodded reluctantly, and they uncuffed me, leading the way back to the Swenson house. As we descended into the basement, my heart raced with dread, fearing what we might find. The basement was eerily quiet now, devoid of the malevolent force that had once controlled me. The ketchup-smeared bottles and crimson trails remained as eerie reminders of the horrors I had experienced. We searched every corner, every crevice, but found nothing out of the ordinary. It was as if the entity had vanished, leaving behind only the lingering scent of ketchup and a sense of foreboding. I think more shocking was the amount of ketchup I had consumed, which had previously been on the walls and floor, which was now nowhere to be seen. Presumably, it was inside of me. I felt sick. Back at the police station, I was released from custody, but the doubts and suspicions still hung in the air. Sheriff Barnes, though skeptical, couldn't deny the bizarre circumstances surrounding the ketchup massacre and my harrowing experience. He left me with a warning.
You'd best keep your distance from that house, Mark. We'll investigate further, but for now, stay away.
The night air was cool and crisp as I left the police station, my mind still reeling from the inexplicable events in the Swenson house's basement. Sheriff Barnes's warning echoed in my ears as I walked through the dimly lit streets, each step feeling heavier than the last. My anxiety gnawed at me, urging me to flee, to leave this town behind and forget about the horrors I had witnessed. But I couldn't. I wanted to understand the ketchup massacre, needed to understand it. As I passed by a nearby grocery store, the overhead lights beckoned me inside, casting an inviting glow across the aisles of shelves. I wasn't hungry, of course not, not after what I'd just done in the Swenson basement. And yet my feet moved of their own accord, taking me toward the store's entrance. It was as if an unseen force was once again guiding me, pulling me deeper into the store's interior. In the condiments aisle, I stopped and promptly broke out in a cold sweat as I realized where I'd been led. My gaze fixated on the array of ketchup bottles that lined the shelves. Ketchup.
Oh, no. Oh, sweet Jesus, no. Anything but ketchup.
The familiar scent filled the air, tantalizing my senses. All the while, my stomach turned and my mind reeled. Without conscious thought, my hand reached out. I grabbed a bottle, tearing off the cap. The ketchup poured into my mouth, thick and sweet, as if it were a lifeline. I couldn't stop. The bottle emptied within seconds, but my insatiable hunger persisted. Desperation consumed me as I dropped to my knees, scraping spilled ketchup from the linoleum floor with my fingers, shoving it into my mouth. Employees and a handful of customers stared in shock, their expressions a mixture of horror and confusion. But I couldn't hear their gasps and whispers. All that mattered was the ketchup, the crimson elixir that compelled me to consume more. I moved to the next bottle, tearing it open and pouring its contents into my mouth. The taste was overwhelming. A symphony of flavors and sensations that eclipsed reason and sanity. I continued this grotesque ritual, bottle after bottle, until my vision blurred and my body grew weak. My consciousness waned as darkness closed in, threatening to consume me entirely. But just as I teetered on the precipice of oblivion, a pair of arms seized me, pulling me away from the ketchup-covered aisle and into the harshly lit grocery store parking lot. The concerned grocery store clerk who had witnessed my disturbing episode held me firmly, her voice a soothing presence in the chaos of my mind.
Hey, are you all right? What happened in there?
I struggled to form words, my throat raw from the onslaught of vinegar-laced ketchup.
I don't know. Something took control. Forced me to...
She nodded, her expression sympathetic.
You're safe now. We'll get you some help.
As the police were called once again, I was left with the unsettling knowledge that the entity from the Swenson house had not released its grip on me. Then I passed out. I awoke in a sterile hospital room, the harsh white light overhead making my head throb with pain. I could hear the distant hum of the medical equipment and the muffled voices of nurses and doctors outside my room. My body felt weak, and the memories of what had transpired at the grocery store flooded back with horrifying clarity. A doctor entered the room, her face a mask of concern.
Mark, can you hear me? My name is Dr. Reichman. You gave us quite a scare.
I nodded weakly, struggling to sit up.
What happened to me?
The doctor hesitated for a moment before speaking.
You suffered a severe physical and psychological episode, Mark. Your consumption of ketchup in such large quantities was extremely dangerous. We had to pump your stomach to remove the excess condiment. And there's something else you should know.
I watched her, anxiety gnawing at my insides.
What is it?
The doctor's expression grew graver.
While you were unconscious, we ran some tests. It appears that the ketchup you ingested had some unusual properties. We're not entirely sure what caused your compulsion to consume it, but it's unlike anything we've ever seen.
My mind raced, thoughts of the entity and the cursed ritual resurfacing.
You have to believe me, Doctor. It wasn't my choice. Something forced me to eat it.
The doctor raised an eyebrow, clearly skeptical.
Well, we'll need to keep you overnight in our psychiatric ward for observation, sir. Your safety is our top priority.
I was led to the psych ward, confined to a room with padded walls and a single narrow window. My mind was in turmoil,
haunted by the events that had unfolded in the Swenson basement and the grocery store. I had to find a way to break free from the entity's influence, to stop the unnatural compulsion to consume ketchup. The night in the psych ward was long and restless, filled with nightmares of crimson floods and echoing whispers. But by morning, I was released, deemed stable enough to be discharged. I couldn't stay there, not with the darkness that still lurked in our town. Leaving the hospital, I knew I had to uncover the truth about the ketchup massacre and the malevolent force that had taken hold of me. The horrors I had witnessed, the ritual, and the entity hungry for souls were all pieces of a puzzle that needed to be solved. With determination burning in my chest, I set out to investigate further, starting with the Swenson house. I had to understand what had transpired in that hidden chamber, what had driven Rick Swenson and his family to their gruesome fate. Perhaps there were answers hidden within the journal that had been my undoing. I returned to the Swenson house, this time in the light of day. The police tape had been removed, and the exterior appeared deceptively normal. I approached cautiously and quietly, on the lookout for any police presence. Seeing none, and with a sigh of relief, I proceeded. The eerie silence still hung in the air as I entered the house, my heart pounding with each step. In the basement, I was pleased to find the journal where I had left it, and hurriedly perused it once again, doing my best to try and decipher its cryptic symbols and writings. It spoke of an entity from another realm, a being of immense hunger and authority. The ritual that Rick Swenson had unknowingly unleashed had bound the entity to our world. And as ridiculous as it sounded, ketchup, of all things, was the conduit through which it could feed. As I delved deeper into the journal's pages, I began to piece together the components of the ritual. It involved a series of incantations, gestures, and the consumption of ketchup in large quantities. I shuddered at the thought of what I had been compelled to do in that place. I imagined I would be losing sleep over it for years, if not decades. With newfound knowledge and a growing sense of dread, I realized that the only way to banish the entity and end the curse of the ketchup massacre was to reverse the ritual. I had to find a way to break the connection between the entity and our world. The journal hinted at a way to undo the ritual, a complex and perilous process that involved collecting specific ingredients and performing a counter-ritual. It was a dangerous path, one that would test my courage and resolve to the limit. But I had no other choice. My first step was to gather the ingredients, some of which were rare and obscure. Nervously, I traveled to antique shops, consulted with local historians, and scoured libraries for information on ancient rituals. Fortunately, I was met with no further interference from the entity, and suffered from no compulsions. Each piece of the puzzle brought me closer to understanding the true nature of the entity and the extent of its hatred for mankind. As the days turned into weeks, I uncovered the final ingredient needed to complete the counter-ritual. It wasn't at all what you would expect. It was not some relic from a bygone era, or a vial of some exotic elixir. No. It was mustard. That's right. Ordinary mustard. It sounded wrong in so many ways, but who was I to argue with the journal? What else could I do? I had no choice but to trust it and hope for the best. With the final ingredient in hand, I truly believed I possessed the power to sever the connection between our world and the entity's realm. There was one final hurdle, however.
the concoction had to be administered at the site where the original ritual had taken place, in the Swenson basement. The night of the counter ritual arrived, and I stood alone in the basement, armed with the knowledge I had gained from the journal and the vial of what I suppose you would call a potion. A mustard-based potion that I was convinced tasted even worse than it smelled. But no matter. The air was thick with anticipation as I returned to the Swenson home for what I hoped was the final time. I was surprised to find that even after all this time, the scent of ketchup still lingered. A haunting reminder, I thought, of the horrors that had unfolded here. With trembling hands, I began to recite the incantations and perform the gestures outlined in the journal. Each word and movement had to be precise, and any mistake could prove fatal. The basement seemed to come alive with unseen forces, and I could sense the entity's presence lurking in the shadows. It was furious, and I didn't have much time. As I neared the final step of the counter ritual, I uncorked the vial. Without hesitation, I did as I was trained, splashing a portion of it on the floor, smearing some on the walls and ceiling, and finally ingesting the last of it. All the while, the entity in the corner of the basement seemed to bubble and pulse in silence, seemingly mustering up the energy to manifest fully. I braced myself for whatever was about to happen next. The eerie silence that followed the completion of the counter ritual in the Swenson basement was palpable. I waited, my heart pounding, expecting some sign that the entity had been banished, that the curse of the ketchup massacre had finally been broken. But the basement remained still, and the entity, though it slithered into a crack in the wall and out of sight, didn't appear to be in anything even remotely resembling pain. Seemed more annoyed. To say I was beside myself with confusion and disappointment would be an understatement. Then it dawned on me. The mustard was a ruse, a trap. Of course it was. No one in their right mind would believe ordinary mustard would be the final ingredient in a demon banishing ritual. I felt like a fool. And not only that, I was now in incredible danger. And so was everyone else in my town. I retreated from the basement, my footsteps echoing in the empty house. The entity was elusive and cunning, and it felt in every way as if it had just outwitted my efforts. No wonder it hadn't bothered to stop me from collecting the ingredients. I had failed. I awoke the following morning in my own home, and a feeling of unease immediately settled over me. It was as if the very air in the town had grown heavier. And then, the news came. The awful, awful news. A chilling message reached my ears, delivered by a stone-faced neighbor who had heard it on the radio. The police station had become a house of horrors, mirroring the fate of the Swenson family. Everyone involved in the investigation into the ketchup massacre, including Sheriff Barnes and his officers, had been found dead in the same macabre manner, suffocated and choked with ketchup in the basement of the police station. The shock and horror rippled through our town like a tsunami. The ketchup massacre, once a nightmarish enigma, had taken a gruesome and devastating turn. Fear and paranoia spread like wildfire as residents grappled with the realization that no one was safe, that the entity's malevolent hunger knew no bounds. Funerals were announced for both the Swenson family and the fallen officers, and our town became shrouded in mourning. It was a somber and surreal time, where darkness seemed to loom at every corner. I felt the weight of the tragedy pressing down on me, a crushing burden of guilt and responsibility. I had tampered with forces beyond my understanding,
and my attempts to banish the entity had seemingly led to even more death and suffering. A conflict raged within me. Part of me wanted to flee the town. I felt responsible for the deaths of those officers who had only sought to protect our community. But another part of me knew that leaving would be an act of cowardice, an abandonment of the very people I had sworn to protect. As I stood at the crossroads of indecision, I received an unexpected visit from Mrs. Wallace, my elderly neighbor. She brought a plate of freshly baked cookies, her eyes filled with compassion.
Mark, dear, I know this town is in the grip of something truly terrible, but we can't abandon it. We have to face this together. Find a way to put an end to it. Everything will be okay, dear. You'll see.
I nodded in agreement, but honestly, I didn't believe her. I didn't know if I ever would. The services for the Swenson family and the fallen officers were solemn and heart-wrenching affairs. The entire town gathered to pay their respects, a sea of mourners whose lives had been forever changed by the horrors that had befallen us. It was a reminder that we were bound together by a shared tragedy, that we needed each other more than ever. In the days that followed, I couldn't shake the weight of guilt and responsibility that had settled on my shoulders. The deaths of the Swenson family and the police officers haunted my every waking moment. I was torn between the desire to flee the town and the need to confront the entity responsible for these horrors. Mrs. Wallace's words continued to echo in my mind, urging me not to abandon our community. All the while, the fear that the entity might follow me, as it had once before, gnawed at me like a relentless beast. Finally, unable to bear the guilt any longer, I made a difficult decision. I would leave town first thing in the morning. And so I did. In leaving behind everything and everyone I had known and cared about for decades, I imagined I was also leaving behind the painful memories of the Ketchup Massacre and the guilt that had weighed me down. But my decision to leave had been a cowardly one. I knew it, and I didn't know if I could ever live it down. Mrs. Wallace had pleaded with me not to go, her eyes filled with concern, but I couldn't bear the thought of staying, of facing the entity and the darkness it represented. But she had no way of knowing the extent of my involvement or what I'd been through, the things I'd done to try and save everyone. In a way, I suppose, I felt like I wasn't simply leaving them behind. In my mind, I was sentencing them all to death, and that made everything so much worse. In my new town, thousands of miles away, I hoped for a fresh start. I settled into a quiet neighborhood, surrounded by strangers who knew nothing of my past. I found a new job and tried to rebuild my life. And for a while, it seemed like I had escaped the horrors of my previous life. The nights were calm, the days uneventful. The Ketchup Massacre became a distant, haunting memory, one that I tried desperately to forget. But then, the nightmares began. I would wake in the dead of night, bathed in sweat, the echoes of screams and the smell of ketchup filling my senses. The nightmares were vivid, as if the entity that had haunted me had found a way to reach me even in my new home. The people in my new town were kind, their smiles warm, but I couldn't escape the feeling that something was terribly wrong. My paranoia grew, and I found myself watching the neighbors, searching for any signs of any disturbance or calamity. But there was nothing, only the quiet routines of everyday life. I tried my best to relax, I promise you. And then, one fateful day, it happened. All my hopes came crashing down, like a house of cards. It would have been an ordinary Wednesday if it hadn't been for the morning news report that shook me to my core. A massacre had occurred in my new town. A gruesome and horrifying event, resulting in the deaths not of a single family or of a few dozen individuals, but of hundreds. And it mirrored the Ketchup Massacre in every way. Once again, innocent lives had been snuffed out, and ketchup was employed as a cruel and unusual torture device. It made national news and was decried as a bizarre terrorist attack or the actions of deranged cult members. But I knew better. I couldn't believe it. The entity had followed me, its thirst for souls clearly unquenched and seemingly growing. Not only had the guilt I tried to escape caught up with me, but the entity did as well. And now, my new town was paying the price. I knew I couldn't run anymore, as if there was anywhere to run to anyway. The burden of guilt that had plagued me for so long would never be lifted. There was no escape. Running away from my past only allowed my demons time to catch up with me. Overwhelmed by anxiety and grief, I wrung my hands, sank into the nearest chair, buried my face in my hands, and sobbed. I cried for a while, cursing my stupidity and foolishness, feeling sorry for myself, until a scent wafting through the air caught my attention. In shock and dismay, I immediately sobered up and wiped the tears from my face. The vinegar-rich, sickly-sweet odor was unmistakable, and it was growing stronger by the moment. I braced myself as the smell filled the room and watched in silent horror as a fog-like substance, reeking of a condiment-drenched basement, seeped into my apartment from beneath my front door. I would recognize that scent anywhere, that unforgettable stench. Oh God, I thought. I smell ketchup.
I hope you enjoyed The Ketchup Massacre, as written by Craig Groeschek and performed by Jeff Sturdivant, Danielle Hewitt, Drew Blood, Melissa Medina, Olivia Steele, and Justin Reynolds. Jeff Sturdivant writes about the absurd, the macabre, and general strangeness of the human experience. When he isn't writing, he drives a brown truck and delivers packages. When he's not doing that, usually he's getting into trouble. If you see him, avoid him, but buy his books because they're good. You can hear more of Olivia Steele and Melissa Medina right here on our very own network. Danielle Hewitt can be heard over on the Creepy Podcast at www.creepypod.com. Justin Reynolds has an intense adoration for music. He loves all the artistic and creative endeavors of life, from the beautiful to the ugly. On to the shows. Longtime resident Otis Gyrie has his very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew, who you heard earlier, has his own show called Drew Blood's Dark Tales, airing Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out the Fear from the Heartland archives, featuring more than 120 episodes.
Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. See you next Monday. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs, or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.